Hey everyone, I just want to make a quick announcement. This is our final episode of 2024. We're going to take a couple weeks off, so we'll be dark for 2 weeks, but we'll be back with a new episode on January 5th, 2025. Our Patreon supporters at the Madness Producer level will still get their December Patreon exclusive episode somewhere around the end of December. So from everyone here at Team Madness, we want to wish you a safe and happy holiday season. We'll see you in the new year. Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes. Go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts for ad-free episodes. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
There are many euphemisms to describe the act of forgiveness. Burying the hatchet, wiping the slate clean, turning over a new leaf. We like to believe that once granted, forgiveness is the first step toward a new beginning, a fresh start. But that's not always the case. Sometimes, forgiveness can be a mask that hides something far more insidious. A calculated decision to punish someone slowly and methodically under the guise of reconciliation. Mental health professionals have long observed this phenomenon in some relationships scarred by infidelity. The betrayed partner might outwardly accept the apology, but inwardly, they maintain a ledger of pain, one they intend to collect on day after day. What makes this form of retaliation particularly devastating is its ability to wear the clothes of virtue. The aggressor can point to their patience in working through the betrayal, their support of their partner's rehabilitation, and their commitment to keeping the family together. All the while, their target slowly crumbles beneath an endless barrage of calculated cruelty. A death by a thousand cuts, delivered under the banner of love. Join me now as we examine the murder of Michael Ritchie Sr., a 51-year-old Boston firefighter and father of three. You'll hear how what first appeared to be a tragic fatal accident soon revealed the far darker story beneath the surface. And how a terrible mistake in 2018, Michael was forced to pay every single day for the next 2 years, before paying the ultimate price, his life. If someone told you, you were a good Jake, that phrase might not have any meaning to you. But if you were a firefighter in Boston, Massachusetts, it would mean everything. In Boston's firefighting culture, being a good Jake is an almost sacred title passed down through generations of firehouse legends since the 1800s. Nobody knows exactly where the nickname came from, but one thing is abundantly clear. Being called a good Jake isn't just a compliment. It's seen as the highest praise a firefighter can receive from their fellow crew. In Boston, where the firefighters' traditions run as deep as the city's oldest cobblestone streets, being called a good Jake is a badge of honor earned only through fearlessness in the face of fire and smoke. In early 2021, there was no doubt that 51-year-old Michael Ritchie Sr. was a good Jake.
So when I first met him 15 years ago, we worked in the same district, basically. And about 12 years ago, I started working in the same firehouse as he. I had a supervisory position, and he was a firefighter. We worked together for a few years there.
Michael Dillon, a district chief with the Boston Fire Department, worked with Michael Ritchie for many years. During those years, he noticed that Michael was one of the department's most competent, loyal, and reliable firefighters. And because of this, Michael was offered a major promotion.
I was the captain of Engine 14, and he was the firefighter on a ladder 4. In April of 2017, I asked Mike if he would become my aide. I consider it a crucial role. I use Mike as a technical advisor for me at incidents. I would rely on his expertise and his experience. He would do day-to-day administrative functions for me. He would take care of the equipment we were assigned. But most importantly, I would rely on him at an incident to let me know if it was progressing properly, if we needed more resources. He accepted, fortunately.
The chief's trust in Michael went far beyond his technical skills. He saw him as someone who didn't just show up for work, but took on every task with commitment and integrity. Michael was more than just a firefighter to his crew. He was a dependable presence, someone you could always count on.
Yeah, just when he showed up to work, he was ready to go. Anything I ever asked him to do was done quickly. He's just a great guy.
Michael was seen as a beacon of reliability, loyalty, and integrity inside the firehouse. But what hardly anybody knew was that within the four walls of his own house, there was a completely different story. January 28, 2021 was a wintry Thursday in Marshfield, Massachusetts, a coastal town steeped in history, located about 30 miles south of Boston along the southern shore. Founded in 1632 by a signatory to the Mayflower Compact, Marshfield remains an ideal suburb for commuters who work in the big city, but prefer to live in relative peace and quiet. For Michael and his wife, 46-year-old Zumba instructor Christine Ritchie, Marshfield's family-friendly environment, with its good schools and beautiful parks, have been the perfect place to raise their children. Two sons, Angel and Michael Jr., who are now adults, and their 16-year-old daughter Sophia. That day, snow was on the ground, and Michael Ritchie was beginning his usual four-day weekend. As a Boston firefighter, Michael's work schedule was typical. He worked a 24-hour shift and got 2 days off, then another 24-hour shift, followed by 4 days off. When his daughter Sophia got home from school that day around 2 p.m., Michael went to Dunkin' Donuts before returning to shovel the snow outside. Sophia spent the afternoon in her upstairs bedroom, but not long after Michael stepped in from the cold, she heard a sound that had become all too familiar inside their home. Her parents arguing downstairs. Arguments between Michael and Christine were a near daily experience, and according to Sophia, they'd been going on for more than 2 years.
It wasn't alarming to me. I was used to it. It tended to my new normal.
Sophia did her best to tune out the argument downstairs, but nothing could completely drown out her mother's screams as she berated Michael endlessly. She heard the sounds of bumping and banging as the intensity increased. And then suddenly, it all went silent. For Sophia, silence usually meant that her father had walked outside to smoke a cigarette and defuse the situation. But this day was different.
She just called my name for me to come downstairs. She sounded very panicked.
Sophia walked down the stairs and saw her father laying motionless on the living room floor.
My dad was laying down on the floor. She was near my dad. She was sitting right next to my dad. She was just she was panicking. Just very shaky, crying, hard to breathe. That's how she was when I first came down. She told me to call 911.
When Sophia called 911 at 4:45 p.m., she had no idea what had happened to her father. Her mother also seemed unable to tell her what had happened. She suffered from occasional panic attacks and appeared to be in the midst of one. Sophia did her best to tell the operator what was going on, but all she could relay was that her father appeared to have fallen down and was now unconscious. Marshfield Patrol Officer Chris Martin was one of the first responders to the Ritchie home.
We entered the house, and it was kind of like a living room or a dining room off a kitchen. And there were two females in the kitchen area, as well as a male that was on the ground on his back. Didn't appear to be responsive. At that time, I didn't know his name. I mean, there was a lot going on there. It was kind of a frantic scene. She was frantic, hyperventilating, yelling, screaming. She said that he was having a manic episode and then suddenly collapsed. The fire department arrives on scene. They place him on a backboard, take over care. They put him in the ambulance.
Christine stating that Michael had collapsed during some sort of manic episode was critical information that fire paramedics like Christopher Brantley relied upon while attempting to resuscitate Michael.
They were performing CPR on the patient, and they were preparing to apply the AED and ventilate him. He was unresponsive at the time. Initially, and I can speak for myself, my primary survey, I didn't see any outward signs of trauma, any gross injury, any blunt force trauma, any massive bleeding or anything like that, which is usually what we look for as regards to an unresponsive patient.
Police stayed inside the home with Christine while EMTs loaded Michael into an ambulance. By this point, the paramedics believed Michael had most likely suffered a heart attack and were attempting to restore his pulse. To provide him with better care, Michael's shirt was cut off from his body. And that's when they made a shocking discovery.
As Firefighter Cohen exposed the patient and cutting off his shirt, we discovered a penetrating wound to the patient's chest.
Michael appeared to have been stabbed in the heart. Before racing him off to the hospital, paramedics told Officer Martin what they'd just discovered.
A few minutes later, seconds maybe, they come back in, and what they had said to me, that they found a stab wound on his chest.
The only thing that Christine had told Officer Martin up to that point was that Michael had suddenly collapsed on the floor. With this new information about the stab wound, the officer realized that Christine hadn't been telling the whole truth.
We attempted to speak with her, but she was, again, still frantic, hyperventilating. But eventually, over time, able to calm down.
To help Christine calm down, Sophia retrieved the medication her mother often used for panic attacks. When she finally spoke again, her story had already changed dramatically.
I again asked her what had happened, and at that point she explained in further detail that an argument had ensued between the two. She believed he was becoming manic, so she picked up a steak knife because she was scared, and then at some point Michael lunged at her. It went into his chest.
What Christine was describing was a classic case of self-defense. According to her, Michael was a recovering alcoholic with a long list of mental health struggles. She described him as bipolar and schizophrenic, claiming he also suffered from frequent memory loss. She claimed Michael had been in one of his manic states during their argument that day. She said she grabbed a steak knife to defend herself when he started getting aggressive. She was just holding the knife when Michael lunged at her. When he lunged, Christine claimed, he knocked them both off balance and they fell to the floor, with Michael falling directly on top of her and directly on top of the knife. During an examination of the scene, police found a steak knife lying just a few feet from where Michael's body had been. Although Michael had been rushed to a nearby hospital, he was soon pronounced dead. The fatal knife wound to his chest had pierced his heart and collapsed his lung. But when Detective Jerome McDonald examined Michael's body at the hospital, he observed a series of other wounds as well.
I observed a wound to his left upper breast. There was a hole, and there was blood kind of around that hole, like dried blood. A wound to the back of his shoulder blade here, like a dark red wound in his shoulder blade. Specifically on the right hand, there was a couple marks, like small shot marks.
In addition to his fatal chest wound, Michael also had a deep penetrating knife wound to his back, something that could not have occurred during the altercation, as Christine described it. And the sharp marks on Michael's hands appeared to be defensive wounds. When Christine was asked about the additional wounds, she couldn't explain them. Based on her inconsistent statements to police, Christine was arrested later that night and charged with murder. But she continued to maintain that it was Michael who'd attacked her. It was time for detectives to interview Michael's family and friends to find out what had really been going on inside the Ritchie home.
I've known him since we've been 4 years old. We're a couple doors down from each other. He was my brother.
Mark McDonald was Michael Ritchie's lifelong best friend. They'd grown up together in the Hyde Park neighborhood on the south side of Boston.
We went all the way up into the high school years. And after high school, we split up a little bit when he went into the military and I went to the military. It was two different assignments, but we stayed very close.
Mark and Michael joined the armed forces straight out of high school. Michael joined the army and served in the Persian Gulf during Operation Desert Storm in the early 1990s.
And then after the military, we re-engaged, and not too long after that, he moved to the South Shore. We were back together.
It wasn't long after leaving the army that Michael decided to become a firefighter. Mark started his own private business, Massachusetts Code Compliance, a team of licensed fire suppression contractors who installed, repaired, and maintained sprinkler systems. During his off days from the fire department, Michael often worked with Mark as a contractor.
He was great. He was one of the best guys everybody wanted to be with him, and he was a great worker. And he was always fun to be around.
When Michael married Christine and started his own family, Mark was automatically given the honorary title, Uncle Mac, to his children.
And his daughter, Sophia, was my goddaughter. And all three of them, they were very close to me. They called me Uncle Mac.
For two decades, this version of Michael and his family was all Mark had ever known. Likewise, all three of Michael's children told detectives that their household was full of nothing but love and happiness until just about 2 years before their father's death.
And it changed. Near the end, it changed. He was not happy. Kind of hard to say. We're still best friends. It's just that I think he went in a different direction. He needed to work on some things.
In the fall of 2018, Michael confided in Mark that he and Christine were considering a divorce.
I basically said I'm going to back him like I've always done. He's been my brother and he's my family. But he also knew that I told him forever I'd take care of his family, just like two friends would do. So I was looking after the benefit of the kids and them, but mostly what the effect would be on the kids. And that was our conversation. I did try to put some reality into the situation, saying if this is where we're going to go, just understand you're going to have a lot of steps ahead of you. Like, we have to think, what are you going to do? Are you going to be able to stay home? Are you going to have to live somewhere else? Firehouse, the shifts, you know. We tried to lay down the plus and minuses of everything.
What Mark didn't know at the time was that Michael had already started seeing another woman who was a mutual friend of theirs, a pediatric hospice and palliative care nurse, Janine Bouchard.
I think when I first met him, I knew he worked for a friend, Mark, doing sprinkler systems. My friend and I would meet at the BBC, our restaurant and bar in Pembroke, a couple times a month, on like Thursdays, sometimes a Friday. Just hanging out there, he would be there sometimes with Mark or guys he worked with.
For approximately 8 months, Michael and Janine had been nothing more than casual acquaintances who occasionally ran into each other at the bar. But in August 2018, Mark told her that his relationship status had changed.
By the end of August, he had said that they both agreed that the marriage was over. He came to my house. We would meet at the beach. We went out and grabbed a pizza. I was told that their marriage was over, that they both mutually agreed to separate. She wasn't wearing her rings.
Janine and Michael's relationship soon became intimate. And for 6 weeks, everything seemed great. In early October, Michael told Janine that he and his wife were taking steps to make their separation official.
I talked to him before the weekend, maybe Thursday. He said that he and Christine had sat down and talked it out. They talked about who was going to stay in the home, you know, what their plans were. And he said that they were going to sit down and tell the children over the weekend.
But then, out of the blue, Michael suddenly changed his tune.
He had texted me that, I think, Sunday morning and said, "We're over. I need to end this. I will call you later. Please don't say anything. Just listen." I think I just said, "Okay." Then he called later that evening. Basically, "We're over. You never meant anything to me." It was very, like, scripted. A couple months, maybe a month or two later, I had several missed calls one night, like 10, 11 o'clock at night. I did not call him back. And then I think days later, there was another couple missed calls and then another call I did answer. I don't love you. I didn't love you. I love my wife. Very monotone. I just said, okay.
Michael had been telling Janine all kinds of things about his marriage, and they were all true. Michael and Christine's relationship had indeed been on the rocks, and they were contemplating separation. And although we'll never know the exact dynamics between Michael and Christine at this time, two things happened in October 2018 that we know for sure. One, Christine became aware that Michael was having an affair with Janine. And two, Michael and Christine decided to work through their problems and save their marriage. According to Christine, Michael literally got down on his hands and knees and begged her to stay. That same weekend, Michael and Christine gathered their three children together and told them about the problems they were having. Michael admitted he'd been having an affair and also admitted to being an alcoholic. In Christine's eyes, Michael's heavy drinking was the root of all their problems, including his recent affair. According to his children, their dad often drank an 18-pack of Bud Light by himself throughout the day. With Michael's promises to reform, Christine promised to forgive him and work things out. By November 2018, Michael had completely stopped drinking and was attending regular Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Sitting beside him at almost every meeting was Christine. They began going to couples counseling, and Michael started seeing a therapist. From the outside, they appeared united, dedicated to repairing their marriage and supporting Michael's recovery. But in reality, Christine had seized control of Michael's life, dictating every choice, setting every boundary, and deciding each step he took. Under her direction, he deleted his social media accounts, got a new phone number, and stopped socializing with his coworkers after hours. He also distanced himself to anyone Christine deemed as a risk to his recovery. Michael replaced his old friends with new ones from his recovery community, reshaping his world around Christine's demands. The first person to really take notice was, of course, Michael's best friend, Mark. But it wasn't just that Michael wouldn't hang out with them anymore. Mark noticed other changes as well.
Okay, physically, he looked like he didn't look good. As other words, he didn't look like the Mike I knew when everybody knew, to the point where we'd ask, is everything okay? Or pull him aside, is everything all right? Because he had scratches a lot on his face, a lot. He had a fat lip. He had a bleeding nose. One time we thought his nose was broken. We asked him if everything was all right, something you want to talk about.
Over the next few months, Michael worked with Mark less and less and eventually quit altogether. Inside the Ritchie household, the children also noticed dramatic changes in their parents' relationship, and not for the better. Michael Jr. describes what he witnessed.
He was a lot more quiet, not a lot of one-on-one time between the kids and our dad. He was there, but he wasn't present, if that makes any sense. The house felt very tense, and it was very uncomfortable.
According to Michael Jr., his mother always started arguments with his father, and the arguments were always about the same thing, the affair.
If it wasn't every night, it was every other two nights. It was very often. It was, do you love her? Were you going to start a family with her? And how they had sexual intercourse together.
Christine became obsessed with knowing everything that had happened between Michael and Janine. She quizzed him about specific times and dates, growing increasingly agitated when he couldn't remember every detail she demanded. During one particular heated argument in June 2019, Christine went to the kitchen and grabbed a knife. She then held it up and began running toward Michael to attack him. Fortunately, Michael Jr. intervened by grabbing his mother and restraining her. But this wasn't the only time Christine would introduce a knife into their arguments. The children also witnessed Christine threatening suicide by knife on multiple occasions. These incidents would take on a darker significance in light of Michael's eventual murder. In October 2019, Michael and Christine vacationed in Hawaii, where they decided to renew their wedding vows. But this hopeful gesture did little to change Christine's obsession. In December, more than a year after the affair had ended, Janine Bouchard received an unexpected knock on her door.
She knocked on the door and I opened it and she said, do you know who I am? And I said, no. And she said, seriously? And I realized it was her. So I stepped outside. She said, I need to talk to you. So I stepped outside on the deck. At first, started yelling and screaming. How could you do this to me? That was my husband. She was kind of all over the place. There was yelling and screaming. There was crying.
Janine explained to Christine that she'd been under the impression that Michael's marriage was over at the time of the affair.
She agreed. I said, well, if you both agreed that the marriage was over and that you had moved on, he was moving on, you had a conversation, then why am I wrong to think that we couldn't date? And she said, because he was my husband. She asked a lot about dates, where I was on certain dates. I didn't recall a lot of them. She had asked if he had bought me a birthday present, more so about dates and where I was and what we did. I told her I was truly sorry for my part, that I wish that I had waited for them to truly be legally divorced before anything moved on in our relationship. And, you know, I can't take it back, but I do apologize and I wish them happiness. She said she forgives me and she asked if she could give me a hug.
Janine believed that the matter was settled, but a month later, Christine left Janine a voicemail.
She asked if her and Michael could come over and see me and talk because she thought he needed that for his therapy. A little while later, I texted her.
In no uncertain terms, Janine told Christine that she no longer wanted to meet face to face, but she did agree to a short phone call.
She had another couple of dates that she needed to know about. I don't remember the date now, but I remember I was on a work conference in Memphis, so I said I was not there, so I can't help you.
Needless to say, Janine wasn't happy about being dragged into the drama between Michael and Christine. But that wasn't the end of it. In March 2020, Christine again showed up unannounced at Janine's doorstep.
I had just gotten home from work. So as soon as I came in, I took my scrubs off and I was about to get in the shower. My daughter came into my room and said that Christine was there. I told my daughter to tell her to leave, that I had nothing else to say. And then my daughter came back in and said, she said she's not leaving until she talks to you. So she said, I told her that if she doesn't leave, I'm going to call the police. I said, go ahead. And then I received a text from Christine.
The text message read, if she calls the cops, I will have all of it plastered everywhere for all to see.
Well, at this point, the police had showed up. And so she was yelling to them, I need to talk to her. I just have a question. And then she started screaming, she takes care of dying children. Do you know who she is? I'm going to put this all over social media. And they kept asking her to leave. And she kept saying, I'm not leaving until I talk to her.
It took police a full 15 minutes to get Christine to leave. It was also around this time that Mark McDonald spoke to his best friend Michael in person for the very last time. Michael, accompanied by Christine, visited Mark's office as part of Step 9 of the Alcoholics Anonymous program, making amends to those he had harmed.
You look tired. He was hunched over, and I literally thought he worked all night or something because he looked like that. She was pretty busy as far as telling me how things were going, catching me up on things with AA and how she's going now.
During this conversation, Michael barely said a word. Instead, Christine dominated the conversation.
Just as we were kind of getting up to go out, they might have been in there a half hour. And as they were getting up to leave, because, I mean, it was during business hours as well, they were leaving the door. My office is on a second floor in a joint area where there's a lot of other offices. As my door opened, Christine went into, she started screaming. It was probably about 5 minutes worth of, I asked her to please be quiet. It's a place of business and people don't want to hear it. And we had some exchanges back and forth. Mike never said a word. They went down the stairs and then they finally left.
At that moment, Mark witnessed just how quickly Christine could go from zero to screaming without being provoked. Something the Ritchie children had witnessed almost daily for 2 years. Even Michael's new best friends from his recovery community became increasingly concerned as 2020 progressed.
There was a decline in Michael's participation in the recovery community and in our personal relationship.
Robert Higgins, who'd become one of Michael's best friends through the South Shore Peer Recovery Program, talks about how concerned he became.
I was calling him, I was texting him, and I went over to the house actually when I hadn't heard from him, and I knocked on the door. He looked tired, he looked gaunt, looked like he hadn't slept. His complexion was, he looked like a defeated man. He didn't invite me into the house, and I could see that the house was dark. I told him that I loved him and that if he wanted to come to my home and stay for a while, he could.
By the time detectives had finished interviewing Michael's family and friends, in the wake of his death, the disturbing dynamic between Michael and Christine had become abundantly clear. For nearly 2 years after his affair with Janine Bouchard, Christine had both physically and psychologically tormented Michael on a daily basis. She exerted complete control over his life and isolated him from both family and friends. Every one of Michael and Christine's children told police that their dad was never physically violent toward them or their mother, but they'd all seen marks their mom had left on him. To the outside world, she wore the mask of a forgiving spouse loyal and devoted, but behind closed doors, she was anything but. Christine had no intention of forgiving, and even less of forgetting. During Christine's trial for second-degree murder in 2024, Massachusetts state prosecutors summed up the entire situation during their opening statements.
He did everything he could to try to make things right and keep his family together. He worked on himself, he went to AA, he worked on his relationship with his children and his wife. He did everything his wife asked him to do. For over 2 years, her inability to get over that affair increased. This affair was like a pot of water simmering on a stove. And over the period of time, Christine continued to turn up the heat on that pot by bringing up that affair over and over until that simmering pot of anger, jealousy, and control boiled over on January 28, 2021.
After establishing the history between Michael and Christine, the prosecutor's case for murder was twofold. First, they highlighted the fact that Christine initially told police that Michael had simply collapsed on the floor during some sort of manic episode, only changing her story to self-defense after being confronted with the evidence. They suggested that Christine's initial lack of honesty with first responders might have been the difference between life and death for Michael.
Because had she said she stabbed him, perhaps the help would have been quicker or different, or the response would have been different altogether. Because had she said anything remotely sounding like, I stabbed him, or he came at me and I had to stab him, they would have responded differently. That's what their jobs are for, to respond and help. And know what? Their help is only as good as the information provided. And she failed miserably.
And secondly, Michael had been stabbed in both his chest and back, making Christine's story that Michael had lunged into the knife impossible.
Ladies and gentlemen, the only way to put an end to Christine Ritchie's pain, anger, jealousy, and rage that consumed her was to put an end to the very person who caused that pain. She did so by stabbing Michael Ritchie intentionally in his heart and then stabbing again in his back. Cut his back, and I suggest to you, he injured his hands trying to defend himself from that armed woman with a knife filled with rage. I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, the evidence is clear that this is a woman who has tried to do this before. This is a woman whose knife of choice are the very knives that she used to kill her husband. If he lunged at her, maybe that would explain the one wound. How do you claim self-defense, ladies and gentlemen, or that you had to be put in that situation when you also stabbed him in his back? She stabbed him in his back. She stabbed him in his heart.
At trial, Christine elected not to testify in her defense. In fact, her defense team didn't call a single witness to the stand. But during closing arguments, her defense proposed a completely new and alternative version of events.
She's suicidal. She goes to that drawer and she grabs a knife and she holds it to herself, maybe to her wrist, maybe to her neck. When Michael sees that during the argument, he gets upset and he runs into that room and he tackles her. And as he's tackling her, she hits the ground. She still has that knife in her hand. As she's plunging that knife towards her own ribcage, just below the breast, and Michael's arms are around her. And that is the first stab. She might not at this point even know that she stabbed him, but he knows. All of his adrenaline is going and now he's focused. This time he doesn't make the mistake he made the first time. He grabs her arm first and they start moving around with that knife. And as she pulls away to get that knife back, the two of them stumble off that ledge onto the floor, and the knife is still between them. He falls in right into the knife, penetrating the center of his chest.
This was now the third version of events presented by Christine, and one that was specifically calculated to explain the stab wound on Michael's back. In this version, Christine was in the process of stabbing herself when Michael heroically threw his body between the knife and her chest. Like some sort of Secret Service bodyguard diving in front of a bullet. After saving Christine's life, they tragically tumbled to the floor, resulting in Michael accidentally stabbing himself in the chest. Needless to say, the jury wasn't convinced, and after only 2.5 hours of deliberation, Christine Ritchie was found guilty.
On offense number 001, wherein the defendant, Christine Ritchie, is charged with the crime of murder, is she guilty or not guilty?
Guilty. Murder in the second degree.
As to offense number 002, wherein the defendant, Christine Ritchie, is charged with the crime of assault and battery by means of a dangerous weapon, is she guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
Before sentencing Christine on August 22, 2024, the judge addressed the court.
I have considered the life of a beautiful, humble man, a loving father, a veteran of the United States Army, beloved by his family, a compassionate and kind man who, as a Boston firefighter, selflessly and courageously dedicated his professional life to helping those in the direst of circumstances. That life was taken by his own wife, Christine Ritchie. There is simply no justification for the cycle of escalating abuse and violence she perpetuated against her husband both inside and outside of the Ritchie home. Ms. Ritchie, I sentence you on count 002, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, to no less than 6 years, no more than 6 years in one day. Upon completion of that sentence, I sentence you on indictment 001 to a sentence of life in prison with the possibility of parole in 20 years.
Christine's life sentence won't officially begin until her first sentence for aggravated assault is complete. Christine will not be eligible for parole for 26 years, minus 3 years for time already served. For more than 2 years, Michael Ritchie Sr. suffered in silence behind closed doors, a fact that might seem incomprehensible given his reputation. A military veteran and a seasoned firefighter, the very definition of a tough guy. Perhaps this image of strength kept others from intervening or kept Michael from reaching out for help himself. In a cruel twist of irony, the same traits that made him exceptional at protecting others left him vulnerable to abuse at home. In the end, Michael's story reveals how forgiveness can become more dangerous than outright rejection when wielded as a weapon. His death serves as a stark reminder that domestic abuse knows no gender, no profession, and no social boundary. During impact statements, Michael's son, Michael Jr., describes how he continues to see his father as an enduring role model.
No words on the page can surmise or even begin to describe the amount of anger, pain, confusion, and hurt I've been carrying with me since my father's death. This whole situation has sucked. I never thought to imagine that I would have to be testifying on behalf of my father's death, and at the other end of it would be the person I used to call my mom. As I mentioned in my testimony, my dad was my, and is my, still my hero. He's the person I looked up to and tried to live my life the way he did. He was that constant example for me to live my life selflessly, putting others before myself, and to be that helping hand for anyone, and to enjoy the time that I have left, and to make the most of it.
Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @madnesspod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.